Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door four times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. In order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a gigantic 25% off of your order. That is fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Guys,
want to
go see a dead body?
Sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
My name is Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. I am calling in from rainy, stormy Austin, Texas. Brez is a little bit further away, I think, at the moment. So
I'm in New Jersey. They have some of the world's greatest smokestacks and strip malls, and I can't wait to check those out. No, I'm in Marbella, Spain on a secret mission and just got back from Pompeii, Italy, with friend of the show Tom Hiddleston in his new Nat Geo documentary. So yeah, I'm kind of bouncing around the world, but happy to be here with you, Eric, and talk Stephen King. Everywhere I went, in every airport, which I've been in multiple ones on connecting flights, I always look for those Stephen King International covers. Didn't see any cool ones this time, but hopefully I gotta maybe look up a couple online. I was so curious what he would be. What would Stephen King be in Italy? What some of those covers look like?
I don't know, but there would be a horrendous Dino De Laurentiis accent.
That's Sam and Daddy.
Hey. It would be a lot of doing the finger thing, doing the hand, Italiano. But I'm very happy that you're taking time out of your travels to join us. This is going to be a really fun chat. And it's all based around a question that we get very, very often here. One of the most frequent mailbag questions whenever we do Q&As. One of the things that we always get asked is, what's a good starting place for a new Stephen King reader? Sometimes the context...
Yeah, Tom Hiddleston asked us that question when he was on the show.
He did. There we go. I tied it into Tom Hiddleston somehow, unintentionally.
I'm going to bring up Tom Hiddleston five more times.
please do. He is our new best friend. Well, your best friend, and I'm just going to ride those coattails. But sometimes the context is like Tom Hiddleston, where it's like, what does an adult do when they, you know, kind of want to dip their toes into the world of Stephen King? But more often than not, it's a parent of a kid who's curious about King, or at least a parent who's wanting to try to push their kid into reading Stephen King. And where does a curious kid starting with Stephen King start? Because I can pretty much, you know, I can speak for myself, and I assume everybody else on this this chat at the moment, but like, we all read King at a probably irresponsibly young age. But the big question is, do you throw them into the deep end with something that'll shatter their reality, or do you kind of ease them in? And I swear to God, I'm finally getting around to introducing the guest for today, and we're tackling this topic with a returning guest who just so happens to be one of the most exciting voices in horror fiction. You know him from When the Wolf Comes Home, Nestling, and his recent kick-ass short story collection, I Know a Place. Mr. Nat Cassidy, welcome back to the show.
Hello, hello. It's good to be here from just boring New York City. I'm not in Spain right now. I'm just in hot New York City. Yeah, but I have been noticing that I've been making this gesture a lot, so I hope this at least ties in a little bit.
For those listening, he had just put his middle fingers up. It's really weird. No, he was doing the Italian hands.
Yeah.
Italian hands. Hey. We can thank you for this topic, because I asked if you wanted to come back on the show, and you're the one who was like, you know, this might be an interesting thing to discuss, specifically because you just reread a certain title that we might get into. We're definitely getting into it, or else we don't have a fucking show.
We'll think about it.
So we're going to do that, but I want to start off by kind of talking about you know, my go-to answer for this is usually short fiction. If you know, I don't know if things are different today. Maybe it's just me being an old man, but it feels like kids read more when I was a kid. And so, you know, maybe I'm underestimating today's youth. But, you know, I'd always thought that getting King into or getting kids into King would be the best way to do that is with the shorter work, because you can get those little quick hits in that instant gratification of a good short story where you can do it in one sitting, maybe make you curious. You can read multiple things and you'd get different flavors of King. I think that for the purposes of this chat, I really want to talk about novels, starter novels. But, you know, what do you guys think of? Do you think that it's maybe a good idea to maybe start with a little teaser, like a little appetizer pre-movie, you know, like a little good teaser trailer, you know? What do you think?
What do you think, Nat? We'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a terrible idea in this age of more limited attention spans, myself included. So it's not the worst idea. I'm very curious, like what your like go-to short stories mm-hmm. would be, because the thing about King, as we know, is like he's got so many short stories that, like, I don't know how many converts you're gonna get if you're like, hey kid, read Blockade Billy or something like that.
Right.
But Try I mean,
the
maybe.
Library policeman.
Yeah. What kid doesn't enjoy that story?
I read that as a kid, and let me tell you, it's if I'd started with that, I don't know how never, much I would have.
Eric
stuck with
never
Stephen
returned
King.
A library book late again, though. So
no, I did. No. I learned my lesson.
And he's always got red licorice in his pocket at all times. I mean, that's a fascinating choice too, because I think every story in Four Past Midnight probably should have been a short story,
yes.
instead of a novella that they are.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, although just as you know, just for argument's sake, so I can be contrary, I was shocked to learn on my recent short story kind of press circuit, mm-hmm. my short story collection press circuit, a lot of people really don't like short stories. And there are a lot of people that like really have a hard time, especially with like short story collections. They don't like the feeling of that brief commitment. Like they feel like they would much rather, if they're going to read, they want to spend the time with a book that is a much more full and richer experience. And that they find short stories to almost be not worth that sort of like herky-jerky sort of experience of like you get out.
These are people in general? I mean, interrupt
yeah,
you, like,
I've heard a lot. Mainly just people in general, you know, particularly okay. like book influencers and stuff like that, like the people I was speaking to. But that sentiment came up a lot, that they're like, I normally don't like short story collections. Mm. So I don't know. I don't know if there should be, you know what might be an interesting pick is that Stephen King at the Movies short story collection that has like, 5 or 6 little short stories. Like it was a really small little Signet paperback. So maybe that's like the kind of compromise of like you can watch movies for all of these short stories.
Right.
But yeah, I mean I'm also with you. I you know, if you're gonna give a kid a short story, it better be like the Jaunt or Survivor type. Like really let them know what they're in for.
Right.
Yeah. I've really come around on this issue. You know, I used to be a strong advocate trying to get my own kids to read Stephen King because I loved him so much, and they're both now at the age where they can check it out. My daughter's going to be 17 soon, and my son is 13. And this may be shocking to you gentlemen and to our listeners, but I actually think young kids should not be reading Stephen King.
No.
They should be actually forbidden.
By Barker.
forbidden. You are not allowed to read Stephen King.
Oh, yes.
Ready for Stephen King. I think we've been going about this the whole wrong way, trying to get them interested by advocating for this story or this novel. When, if you think about when we were young, I guarantee you may have taken it off of like your mom's shelf or your aunt's shelf, but there was an adult in your life who thought, I don't know about this, Natty. I don't know. I don't think you should be reading that. I think there's a lot of swearing in those books and a lot of dangerous ideas. And I think for people of our generation, that was so enchanting and so alluring. And the idea of grown-ups saying, you'll really like this if you just give it a try, is actually It's like spraying the sort of cat repellent around, and they just naturally recoil from it. The only way I've found to motivate teenagers to do anything is to say, you cannot do this one thing. It's the Eve's apple approach to encourage Stephen King. They should not read any Stephen King fiction, and they definitely should not start with The Jaunt.
You're saying it a little jokingly, but I think you're definitely onto something. Kids will always be drawn to the forbidden, as we've discussed, and I think that it wasn't necessarily forbidden for me, but I also had a curiosity about fiction and storytelling that I don't think is as commonplace. I thought it was, everybody felt that way when I was a kid, but I don't know if that was the case when I was a kid, and especially not the case now. When the one thing you don't want to do, I remember I was gifted copies of the Lord of the Rings trilogy when I think I turned 10, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I'd read The Hobbit, you know, in school. And I was like, yeah, fine, whatever. And they gifted me, it was this book set. It was the set of paperbacks that had this kind of realistic fantasy art cover where it looked like real people as the thing, you know. It wasn't like this abstract or really cool, compelling art, but it also looked like real people dressed up for community theater doing this. And so the Gandalf just looked like, you know, some dude that they pulled out of a fucking grocery store with a big, big, you know, white beard, you know. And
you
Bilbo,
look like a wizard.
yeah, Bilbo and Frodo were just look like, you know, I don't know, fucking just random, you know, short cherubic gentleman, you know. I wasn't actually enticed to read that until they were making the movies. I read them before the movies came out, but there is something to that. Like, the more that you want the kids to do it, you know, the there's a piece of it that has to be them being curious on their own, or at least curious, maybe not about Stephen King, but curious about storytelling. I think that's really important that's there, or else nobody's going to give a shit, you know.
We got to make it dangerous again. You cannot read these books. You are not ready. That's why I'm putting them all right here on the second shelf, where they must stay at all times and
at
don't
preteen
dare.
Height.
If you take one off the shelf and open it, I'm not responsible for any bad dreams or feelings of trauma or anything particularly dirty or violent that you might have read. And I think that's enough to light the fuse.
Yeah.
You're and not I'm just going to put the most enticing cover facing out.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I think you need one adult in your life, the one person who's like, yeah, come here, it's all right, I'll tell you what, your parents are actually getting divorced.
The cool
and
uncle.
It is your fault. Right. Like that kind of uncle or grandmother, like you need that person. That's what I had. Was my grandmother said, I was begging people. This I've told you guys this story many times, but I was begging people at 13 to see Pet Sematary, the movie, the original movie. Nobody would take me, partly because they didn't want to take me to this violent, scary movie, partly because I don't think they wanted to see it. My grandmother said, that's a book. I'll buy you the book. And I was so downhearted. Now I have a book to read, but I have a forbidden book to read. And that I really loved. And so I think if you can make him and reading in general seem a little like transgressive, which it can be, I think that'll be more interesting. And I have seen glimmers of hope. You know, my son and I were at our community swimming pool, and the lifeguard was sitting there reading a book. She was reading the book, the novel Perfume.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I was so happy to see this. I don't know what she is, between 16, 19 years old, something like that. I was so happy to see this teenage girl reading a novel that I didn't even say, hey, you're actually supposed to be watching the bottom of the pool for drowning Todd. You go on with your bad self. I saw it looked like she was maybe 14, 15, there with her family at the same pool a different day, reading Of Mice and Men, of all things. Huh. Now, is she reading it because it's advanced placement for high school or something. I don't know. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to go up and ask a teenager questions. So
how you do, fellow kids? What you reading there?
Hey, reading of Mice and Men. The best laid plans go off to stray. I think, but I saw that as like, hey, there. It's the summertime, and here are these teenagers who are reading books, reading full novels. I've heard tell, like in the parental circles, that maybe reading is making a comeback, that there's this pushback against the digitization among, I don't know what generation it is. Gen Z is the one that fully bought into this and is really annoying about it. But now I think the ones coming up behind them are sort of like, actually, I would like to wake up and not stare at a screen, so I'm going to read Of Mice and Men, I guess. I don't know.
Do you question, as someone with kids, I'm genuinely curious, do they want to be scared? Because I can imagine with some people, when you say, like, don't read this book because it's really scary, they might be like, okay, I won't. But if it's like, this is really transgressive, or this is too adult, or something like that, then they're like, aha, I will read that.
I think that's true. One of my kids, my older child, she does not like scary things, and that's all right. If that's not your thing, then that's okay. And my son, he really does like it. He got into the Scream movies, and he really wanted to watch Welcome to Derry because he'd heard about. But this is it. He'd heard about Pennywise.
Yeah,
kids come of age and they hear about Pennywise and like, oh, when can I watch that? Sort of in the way. When we were growing up, you heard about The Shining, you know? Like, that's a weird one. That's really disturbing. So he got into that, and he does read a lot, but, you know, I think the time is coming for him to pick one up, but I'm going to try to leave it to him. I might, but look, how many people do we know who say their first Stephen King book was it? It's the biggest Bible-stomping, Bible-cracking book ever written by him, and... you know, so many people just dove right into this dense fucking novel full of hopping through time and dozens of central characters and interludes and exerludes and weird, crazy stuff. Like, how many people read that cinder block of a book first crack? And that was their love affair with Stephen King.
And to be fair, you know, we had Gory Corey on, you know, who was a teen, you know, like at the time a high schooler that was writing for Fangoria, and she was talking about how, you know, she's God, she might even be out of college now. It's been so long that the show's getting old, man. but she was saying that, like, that her generation was just as into Stephen King, or was way more into Stephen King than she would imagine, and was just maybe just as into Stephen King as my generation was, because of Stranger Things and the Muschietti It films just made it like something that they had to know for pop culture, right? And they were curious about it, and they're curious about what Stranger Things was taking from, you know, from King and all that stuff. So, you know, if that curiosity is there, again, I think that's the center of it. But say you do, you know, in a scenario, you do have an 11, 12-year-old in your life that's saying, I want to read a short story. You know, I'm in this place now. I want to read a Stephen King short story. Do you have one that jumps to mind? Is there one that you would recommend? And that obviously, knowing that every person's different, you want to tailor it to their particular tastes. But is there any titles that jump out? Are there any titles?
Man, that's a good question. I said this jokingly, but you know, my impulse kind of would be for a survivor type or a jaunt sort of thing, just because I'm cruel and want to inflict cruelty upon others. But you know, I could also see if they're like a sensitive kid who likes supernatural or genre sort of stuff. Maybe I was an anomaly, but when I was a kid, I loved, like 11, 12 years old, I loved The Last Rung of the Ladder. I loved The Reach. I loved, like, those weird melancholy stories that bummed me out in a way that, like, listening to a sad song bummed me out. And I could, like, see the power of this one particular storyteller through those stories. Whereas, like, you know, the scarier stories were fun. I suppose if you're like a geeky kid who loves mythology too, like Mrs. Todd's Shortcut could be really cool. And all that stuff. Yeah, man, there's so many. There's a lot of choices.
Well, I can tell you, like, my person, like, I had obsessions of, like, specific short stories when I was a kid, and The Mist was up there. That's more of a novella, I guess, but The Mist, I think, is, like, a good, you know, Training Wheels version of a Stephen King book, right? Yeah. Where you get in and out a little quicker, but it has all those elements. It has all the character building. It has the, you know, the mystery of, like, what's in the mist, you know, oh my God, there's tentacles now. Oh my God, you know, what's the next crazy, oh my God, a spider with a human face, like, what the fuck is going on, you know? I think that the Mist might be an early, a good title for me, but I was thinking 1408 might actually be a really good one too, you know, for like somebody who's never dipped their toe in, because it does feel a little bit like King playing with all of his favorite tropes. You're at least, you know, you got the writer, you got the haunted hotel room, you know, it's a trapped a single location kind of thing. I was thinking 1408 or maybe something like Battleground, another single location story, you know.
Those are all really good suggestions.
Yeah.
The one I would go to is The Reaper's Image.
Mm. The first one?
Yeah. Why not?
All right. I like it.
You laughed at me. Why did you laugh?
What an unexpected pull. That's why.
Really? Because I just think it's very self-contained.
Yeah.
It's an interesting mix. It's halfway Stephen King and halfway Rod Serling. Ray Bradbury, it was written when he was, I think, 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
It was his second short story published. And if you read the first one that he had published in Startling Mystery Stories, remember I had the copy of it that I waved in front of the camera when we spoke to him, Eric? If you read the what's it called? The Glass Ceiling?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, the Glass
Floor.
The Glass Floor, that's it, yeah. That one is not good. And I say that affectionately because I wrote a lot of stories like that as a kid, and I'll never be Stephen King, but the difference between The Glass Floor and The Reaper's Image is the whole way around the world. Like, he, within a few months, really got it together. Just the writing and the pacing of it, but also the atmosphere and the characterization it's all amateur. It's juvenilia in The Glass Floor and in The Reaper's Image. That's a real short story. Like, there's a reason that he republished The Reaper's Image in, I think that was in Skeleton Crew. Mm-hmm. I think he's put out The Glass Floor as like a curiosity through Cemetery Dance or something like that. But it's not. And he's even said in his introduction, like, as I read this, there's a lot I would change. And I've resisted changing it because if you change one thing, pretty soon it's just going to be a whole different short story. It needs a real rewrite. It's the kind of thing, if you had a student and they turned it in, you'd go, this is great.
Right.
Keep going. Keep going. And the Reaper's Image is him keeping going. And it's not about children. It's not about things that necessarily concern kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a spooky looking glass. And these two grown men who go up and see it, and one of them becomes transfixed. And all of the history, kids love that history that, you know, something happened here, and it happened in real life, not far from where we're at. Yeah. And it happened again. And these, you know, this tunnel is haunted. And if you honk your horn, like, all of that kind of ritual and superstition, I think kids really love. And when I was a fucked up, disagreeable teenager, as opposed to the fucked up middle-aged man I am now, I wasn't doing my work in school, and I wasn't reading any of the assigned texts in my English class, but I had this awesome teacher, Mr. Caracella, and he knew that I loved to write, and he knew that I liked to read. I just didn't want to read Mice and Men. So he said, what can I do to get you to read this novel? The novel was Catcher in the Rye. And I was like, I don't know, I just don't like that stuff. I like Stephen King. And he goes, well, I'll teach a Stephen King story. You pick one for me. I'll teach that in class. Everybody will have to read it. We'll discuss it if you promise you'll read this other book. And I pulled the Reaper's image for him. And we had a great conversation in class. What are the blind-eyed statues about? Like, he keeps describing the blind eyes of these things, and he connected that to the mirror being an eye. And I was like, whoa, wait, fuck, I thought I was the one who knew this story. And he read it for the first time, and everybody thought it was really cool. Like, everybody in the class read it, they were hooked. And I was so proud of myself that I felt an obligation to do what he said, and I read Catcher in the Rye, and I loved that novel too. And that's the one where I was like, oh, maybe he knows what he's talking about. I'm going to keep reading the books he suggests. So, yeah, that's my suggestion. Give the Reaper's Image a try.
I love the extra sort of meta-narrative to it, too, of, like, especially giving it to a kid of, like, look, this is the beginning of, like, this incredible storied career. Yeah. And it's an imperfect story. Like, it doesn't have the sheen that I think a lot of other stories might have, which I think makes it a little more approachable in a way. I like that answer a lot. That's a great answer.
Well, thank you. You should be ashamed for laughing at
me. I began derisively.
I laugh at you.
You know, and weirdly, it made me kind of want to change my answer too, for different reasons.
You can't say the Reaper's Image now. That's mine.
Now I'm going to say The Glass Floor.
I would love it if you just repeated Bresnikan's whole story word for word.
I had this English teacher, and I was having a hard time reading. It made me think of a story that I think is technically a bad short story. I don't think it's a very good short story, but it does remind me of what it was like to be that age and looking out for stories that I could kind of relate to a little bit. And at first I was like, Grandma, which is a great story, but Here There Be Tigers. Like, there's something about that of, like, just, like, knowing what it's like to be young and having to go to the school bathroom and seeing a tiger there. There's just, like, the thesis statement that story I could imagine introducing to a younger reader of, like, this is a guy who's going to get you to look at the world differently and to see all the things around the corner that you are surprised to see. There's something about the surreality yet also, like, the groundedness of just, you know, your school bathroom with a fucking tiger hiding there, that I could see that also being kind of effective in the way that like an R.L. Stine Goosebump book effective, because you're like, I recognize this, I see this,
and it's random and it's super short. I think that thing's like 4 pages or something, right?
It's teeny.
Yeah. You know, for younger readers, King himself said he used to read, I think he said it was a bolderized version of The House on Maple Street. That's the one.
Oh, yeah.
Nightmare and Dreamscapes. It's written from the Chris Van Allsburg's drawing, the illustration of the house just rocketing up into the night sky. And I can see that being, if I were asked to read a Stephen King short story to like a middle school class, I think I might choose that one. And I just partly because it's clean comedy, you know.
Yeah. Whereas if I was asked, I would do Suffer the Little Children until they dragged me screaming out of the classroom.
You get the authorities over here. It's him again. He's back. Say,
Miss Sidley's
back. And I'd be like, kid, especially if the teacher's not in the room, be like, hey, kid, so this is how you act with the teacher next time she's teaching a lesson or they're teaching a lesson.
Change a little bit. I think The Raft is pretty good.
Yeah,
you know,
a little rapey. It's a little. We got a little rapey. I guess it's not the adaptation.
The movie's a little
rapey.
Yeah,
but there's there's random fucking going on right in the middle of that.
There's consequences to that too, and I think it's about young people. They're out having fun. They're wanting to get laid. They want to fool around. Yeah. They break the fucking rules. They don't follow the no swimming sign. You know, you can. Yes, that guy definitely like forces himself on her because she's stuck to the fucking. Wooden raft, but because this sludge, the blob is eating her. Like, but the whole story is about you must follow the norms and follow the rules. Yes, it's tempting to see a no, don't play on the grass sign and want to throw around a football. But actually, there are good reasons for these things. You'll get electrocuted. You'll get eaten by the blob. Like you'll get accused of sexual assault. Like, don't do those things. It's wrong. For one, but also there are consequences to that, and that is a short story about fucking consequences. And so, and I like it that it's self-contained. But do you guys read short stories? I mean, I've never written a short story collection. Nat, you have. I love short story collections. I don't think I have ever read a short story collection starting with the first one and working toward the end the way I do with a novel. I buy a short story collection. I flip through and look at the titles. I pick a few. I usually read the first one because that you always lead off with a banger, right? I look through to what interests me, and I'll read two or three short stories, and then I'll put it back until I want to read another. And it doesn't matter if I really love the author. It's in a way, it's sort of like I don't eat the whole box of chocolates at once either. You know, I'll spread them out over a couple of days. But I think. You know, my copies of Night Shift and Skeleton Crew, before I stopped vandalizing my own books, they have little check marks next to the stories because I would check the stories as I read them to keep track of which one I had. And that thing you said about critics and readers not liking short stories because they don't like the start and stop of it. I love short stories because it's like, okay, I've got 20 minutes before I got to jump on an interview or do the King Cast or something, you know? I've got 20 minutes here. I've got a cup of coffee. I'm just going to read something self-contained, you know? And that's when I'll pull a short story collection off the shelf. So I don't know. How do you guys do it? Do you read beginning to end on a short story collection?
I do, yeah. I love, like, to me, it feels like listening to an album from start to finish. And it's like,
yeah, I can see
you
that.
Know, I like seeing how they speak to it. And that is primarily because of Stephen King. I think the experiences of, like, reading, you know, the Night Shift experience is so different than the Skeleton Crew experience, than the Nightmares and Dreams Greatscapes experience, that, like, I look at each one as informing itself of the its contents informing the sort of whole. And then after I've read the whole collection, then I'm much more predisposed later on to just, like, I want to read that story again and just
jump
kind of
around.
Do it piecemeal.
Right. Yeah, I'm too much of a completionist. I have to start at the beginning and end at the end. That's you know, maybe there's a little glimpse into my organized brain where nothing else in my life is very organized. but for whatever reason, when I read short stories, I love what Nat said about it feeling like an album. You know, it's like, you know, you don't go into Dark Side of the Moon and, you know, go just listen to Money and then, you know, go on to something else. Like the you know, there is an orchestrated experience happening with the best of them. Maybe not every short story collection,
that's an excellent argument for that. I mean, I think of them as singles, you know.
Right.
Yes, if I felt like there was something thematic about them. You know, like Winesburg, Ohio is a collection of short stories technically, but it's, to me, that feels like you say, like that feels like an album to me.
Yeah.
Where you're getting the different characters in Sherwood Anderson's story and one is speaking to the other. But I hear what you've made a persuasive argument for that.
But it's that jet-setting attitude that allows you to just like fly to Spain and Pompeii. Like you're living life right. You're not held down by constraints.
I don't play by your rules.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to force you to play by this rule, though. So we've talked about short fiction. We are now moving into the novel. Brez, was your first novel Pet Sematary?
It was Pet Sematary.
My first one was Cujo. Nat, what was your first full novel?
Mine was Pet Sematary as well, because my mom basically was... Brez's grandmother and mom at the same time. She was like, you can read this whenever you want, but don't come crying to me because I don't have time to take care of a scared kid. So it's up to you to read this whenever you want. But then she had like the Signet mass market paperback edition, just like at my height on the shelf, you know, the one with the fucking cat yowling on the front and the back was just in giant script. This is the scariest novel Stephen King has ever written.
Right,
so I was like, that's the one. I'm going to read that first thing. And I was hooked ever since.
So that's interesting. I mean, I feel like you know, in this imaginary scenario, we're you know, we have the curiosity factor. We have, you know, somebody's predisposed. They're wanting you to be that grandma or that cool uncle or whatever. And so, like, then what do you do? Like, this is really an interesting topic, because the idea is, like, do you throw them into the deep end, you know, with something crazy, or do you try to, you know, give them, you know, the water wings as they're jumping into the pool for the first time? Like, what's your guys' instinct on this?
I think it's so hard because every person is different, and you can read someone and know.
Yeah.
If you talk to Tom Hiddleston like we did, and he asks what you should recommend, I just don't get the sense that he's gonna. He might like Pet Sematary, but not as a first entree, you know, as the right.
Everyone starts with Revival. You have to read Revival first.
That's why I think I sometimes recommend The Dead Zone, you know, because I think that's a really cool, supernatural, scary story, but not one that, like, is going to pull your spine out. It'll break your heart, but it's not going to make you... you know, put it in the refrigerator like Joey Tribbiani on Friends reading The Shining. Right. I think Salem's Lot's a good recommendation. I also think Carrie is a great starting point for people. But you know, we're talking about Original King, Original Recipe. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of people respond to 11/22/63.
Right.
A lot of people. And they want to know where, oh, this guy who wrote 11/22/63, what else has he done? And they're not even thinking of him as the guy who wrote The Stand. Maybe they're thinking of him as the guy who wrote It. But I think that book, even though it's another doorstop book, is pretty powerful and grabs.
It hooks you. It hooks you right away, and like, I think you once you make it through the portal the first time, like, which I think is something like 50-60 pages in the book, then the curiosity pulls you throughout the rest of it, and then you're in for the journey. I think that there is something that I would recommend, especially for a kid, you know, somebody in that tween zone, you know, is there's a huge value to seeing yourself represented. And I got so much mileage. Matter of fact, this is the basis of my essay that I wrote for this upcoming thing that you and I did for It. You know, where we can contribute stories about it or essays. Mm-hmm. When I read It the first time, just by sheer coincidence, I was the age of the losers, the young losers. And then I revisited it again in my late 30s, just by coincidence, and was kind of shocked that, you know, when I read the ages of the adult losers, and I was exactly the age of the adult losers. And there's something about that, you know, something special about reading a Stephen King book when you're 12 years old, when there is a 12-year-old in the lead.
Yeah.
There's something that whether it's The Talisman or It, you know, there's something special about the way that he just opens the door for a young reader that you maybe wouldn't appreciate if you read it for the first time as 25 or 26. So my instinct is to go with, you know, or even Eyes of the Dragon is very much in that same vein, you know, like, is to go with something, and not just because, oh, kids only want to read about stuff about other kids, but there is just something about the point of view and being seen. I can't tell you how many people have been on the show. You know, I remember Kate Siegel and Emily V. Gordon talking about just seeing themselves and their friends in the It, you know, group, and feeling seen and represented for, you know, for real, not, you know, some fake version of being a kid.
Eyes of the Dragon and The Girl Who Loves Tom Gordon, I think, are great suggestions for the kid who wants to read. Maybe you have, like, somebody who's eager to read,
right,
and wants a suggestion but scares easily. And so there are just some people who they just don't enjoy that experience of being disturbed. And I think those books are tense and suspenseful without, again, like, you know, melting your soul. So Eyes of the Dragon, I think, is a really fun one. It's a fairy tale, but it's an aged up fairy tale, and so is the girl who loves Tom Gordon, frankly. Like, that's the little girl lost in the woods, you know, one step shy of Red Riding Hood. The Institute is another one I might suggest to a young
reader. It's an interesting choice.
You know, I think that book gets slammed too. I think it's too, the criticism of it is too harsh. I think that the series was not great, but it was, I think it's a pretty good book and it's a pretty fun story. We can argue about that, but I thought it was, I actually enjoyed it a lot, and I thought, yeah, this one, if I for a teenager, it's again, like you, to your point, Eric, it's all about teenagers and also defying authority, you know, special kids, especially if you're reading, you are a special kid this day and age. Like, there's something about you that's willing to spend time thinking about things in the abstract, willing to spend time turning pages instead of flipping your screen around. And I think that notion of you can be brilliant and talented and also defiant is an appealing mix. So
I feel like a kid would also appreciate the weird structural kind of quirks of the Institute too. You know, how it like begins with such a long preamble from another character's point of view. Mm-hmm. And I feel like adults have like, especially if you're like, you work in the arts or something like that, you have like your cynicism and structure hats on, and you're like, why would you begin like this? You know, that's not how you structure a novel. But like, a kid is just like, whoa, like suddenly I'm in like another world, and like now we're with different protagonists. Like, that's fun.
Where that's kind of coming from. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. There's like the promise of kind of subversion.
What young readers don't like is that when he talks about the internet, he calls it the web and stuff like that. You know, I've heard that criticism. Like, why does he call it the web? I'm like, that's what we used to call it. And
that's what we called it back in the day. It was a series of tubes and a web. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like not Blockade Billy. Billy Summers is also kind of a slept-on book for older readers, for like adults and stuff like that.
Right.
That's a damn good book. The Institute and Billy Summers are two books that I forget how much I really enjoyed. Yeah. But going back to what you were saying, Brez, my answer to this question used to be The Dead Zone. That was usually my go-to one. And then I recently reread The Dead Zone. I reread it like last year. And I was surprised, still brilliant, I still love it, it's one of my favorite books, but I was surprised at how, like, meandering it is, in a way, like, how plotless it is for a long time. Like, I think when we think of The Dead Zone, we think of the movie, which is this very compact sort of, like, he gets the psychic powers and he has these series of adventures, and they're all, like, leading up to Greg Stilson.
It's almost a short story collection. There are, like, three different stories that happen.
The book is, you know, it's a 450-page book. Like, there's just a lot of just, like, depression and, like, post-traumatic sort of dealing with losing Sarah and adapting to his life as someone with disability and stuff like that, which is not a flaw at all. But, you know, when I'm thinking of, like, the ideal bulletproof book to give to a new reader, adult or child, I was like, okay, maybe I won't recommend The Dead Zone as much. And 11-22-63 is another one where I'm like, I think that's a perfect book. I love that book, but it's a commitment. And if like people don't like the sort of recurrence of it, which is necessary to the plot, I could see that getting in the way.
I've read some criticism where people are like, it just repeats itself. It's like, that's
the fucking point of the book.
Welcome. Congratulations. To the theme.
Yeah.
I love when you read like Goodreads criticism and it's like, I don't know, people get killed in this book. I don't think I like that. Like,
oh,
well, that's
God.
A fucking murder mystery. Like,
what yeah. Did it have to be so dark? But no, I have since come around to a completely new pick that is one that you just named, in fact, for adults or for young readers. I am kind of in love with this book in a way that I have not been in a long time. But The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, I think, is a quintessentially perfect Stephen King book. Mm. And it is kind of a bulletproof book. I wrote down five reasons for it, if you want to hear them.
Yeah, let's go. I only want to hear four of them, though.
No, four, really, okay.
Kill the weakest reason.
Should I skip around? Should I skip around like it's a short story collection read by a psychopath?
No, yes,
I put
let's
no
hear
thought into this. The first is character. Like, it's got it shows King's character work at, like, you know, as good as it gets, and he's among the best writers at that anyway. The character work is flawless. It's a kid, but it doesn't feel dumbed down, but it also doesn't feel like aggressively you know, in the way that, like, sometimes I could see the criticism of some of his younger children reading older. Like Jake in the Dark Tower sometimes reads like he's like 35. Or Jack in
So does Danny in the
yeah.
show.
And he's
5 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. But like Trisha is like she's 9 and she reads 9 and her understanding of the world is like a 9-year-old's understanding. It's not too young, it's not too cynical. It's beautifully done. And there are all these very brief moments where like we just get like a paragraph of like her mom's POV or her brother's POV, and it's all you need, and it's so beautifully done. The second reason is that it's actually, and this contradicts you a little bit, Brez, but it's scary as hell. I was shocked at how fucking scary it is this last go round. Like, he puts her through it in ways I kind of completely forgot. I kind of remember it, you know, maybe I'm just thinking of the pop-up version, where it was just like, yeah, she makes some bad decisions and she gets diarrhea and like it's a rough time in the woods. But she is constantly making the worst decision imaginable. And is just like going through trial after trial after trial, and like the stuff with the God of the Lost is like deeply cosmic and terrifying and stuff like that. So you can also really see how King does horror. But it's also got a happy ending, so it doesn't have that like nihilism, that like lasting sort of feeling of like, this is gonna fuck me up forever. It fucks you up in the moment, but you get through it. Like, that's the whole point of the book. And it's like, it's as effectively claustrophobic as like Misery or Gerald's Game or Cujo, or even like, you know, the grief of Pet Sematary. It's all in there, but it's in a much more digestible kind of package. Third reason, the prose work, fucking beautiful. There is such beautiful prose work going on in here, because, you know, it's maybe it's either the last or one of the last books written before the accident. And I love his prose work after the accident too, but like his voice is slightly different after that. Like, you know, he also gets like just a little more folksy and stuff like that the older he gets. But this is like all the power of Prime King just kind of concentrated into, you know, a YA length sort of book. So like it's the craft on display. I was stunned at how fucking solid and, again, bulletproof this book is. The fourth reason is that it shows how King can make you care about things that you would never care about. I don't give a shit about baseball at all, which can be a liability as a King fan sometimes. Like, I'm not pulling Faithful off the shelf at random anytime. But like the scenes where she's listening to the baseball game in her Walkman made me cry this time. They're so effectively written and communicated. So like it shows you how great he is at making you care about stuff. It's also like so deeply spiritual. It's as spiritual as The Stand and Desperation, but it without, as you know, the baggage of all the word count, which leads me to my fifth and final reason, which that it lies to new readers, because you're going to read it and think like, oh, this guy writes really compact, tight stories. I want to read what's next. Yeah. And then you're going to find out like, oh shit, I'm in for 1,100 pages of commitment. But already you're like, I know what he can do because I read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. So I'm going to see what it is about or what The Stand is about. So I think it is like the quintessentially, I did a thing for a bookstore that I can't talk about because they're not releasing it until next year. But it was about like the greatest books of the 20th century. And my pick, of course, was It, because like It has everything. But I was this fucking close to picking The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. Mm. That's how in love with this book I found myself. Like, it's just, it's got everything in it. And it's like, what, 200 pages or something like that?
Yeah. It's a short one. Yeah.
Short.
Yeah.
Well, look at Nat actually doing the homework.
Where
I was like, I think this might be good. And you're like, I'm going to break down why, motherfuckers. I'm going to get on a little, give you a little sermon here on it. And I mean, and it's a hell of a compelling argument, too. You know, I like you, I've I remember reading The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon when it came out and going, okay, that's really good.
Yeah.
And then kind of moving on. But it is one that's sticky. And I'm starting to see, in much the same way that Revival got a little bit of a second life as people rediscovered it, you know, after it came out, I feel like The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, I'm hearing more and more people going like, why isn't this one talked about more?
Yeah.
Right. So it is, it's sticking, and on my revisit with it, I remember being way more, you know, into it than I was on my first reading. So yeah, super, I mean, impressive. It's a great idea. I mean, yeah. I think that if I'm looking at my ultimate goal, and in this very specific scenario, I'm trying to get somebody hooked on, hooked in, especially if they're in that tween area, like if they're younger, maybe something else. But if we're talking, you know, between 11 and 13, I'm wanting that person to be getting into the weirdness of the Dark Tower. And so I think that I think I'm going to have to go with Eyes of the Dragon, because that is the training wheels for Dark Tower, right? And that seeds stuff in from the Dark Tower in there. And you know, maybe it's just me, you know, it's like the Al Bundy scenario where I was really good at football in high school and I'm never going to let the kids forget it, right? Maybe that's just me trying to replicate my own personal revelations, but like reading the Dark Tower series when I was, you know, in middle school and early high school, and then having to wait for the new books to come out because they weren't all out when I was reading them, that was such a formative thing for me. And still something that I don't think is replicated. Those books, for all the sloppiness and weirdness and you know, there's straight up Dark Tower books I think are just bad. I think Song of Susanna is a bad book. I really do. I don't think it serves the purpose that he wants it to serve. I wouldn't change anything from it though. Like you know what I mean? It's like even when it's sloppy, I love it. You know, I love that feeling, that kind of unwieldy thing. There's nothing like the Dark Tower. So, I mean, my ultimate goal with getting a kid hooked on Stephen King is to make them make them curious enough and want to follow along the path with Roland and his quartet. So I think because of that, I think I might have to go with Eyes of the Dragon, because I also feel like that's one that you could maybe like seed younger too, where that might be, if you read to your kid at night, that might be a good one to read to your kid, you know, and do like story time, especially now that we can't do the Harry Potters anymore without having to explain how that author went fucking insane. So what do you guys think?
Well, once you get them hooked, they can move on to Nat's When the Wolf Comes Home and you know, I Know a Place. You know, you gotta get them hooked on the dark stuff and
get that good shit.
Yeah. And then there's plenty of great writers out there too to move and find beyond King.
Oh my God, yeah, like that's like one of the most exciting things I think about getting someone hooked on King is like the horror genre then opens up, because right. There's so many people who have been influenced by him too and are in like direct communication with him. You can give him the Stand anthology or the Shining anthology after that, and just be like, go to town. But I'm curious, Eric. In your Al Bundiness, would you then also be like, you have to read the original version of The Gunslinger? Like, ooh, you have to learn about the beast. You have to have all of these like digressions that go nowhere. You need the really dense prose.
Well, I'm kind of torn because I like that he works up to the fucking weird baby language shit that he makes, you know, in the later books, because you know he kind of seeds, you know, otherworldly terms and stuff in those first three.
Yeah.
But it's really around four where suddenly, you know, he starts doing his
the
fucking
size start.
Yeah, his weird speech. And the thing that I don't like about what he did with the revised Gunslinger is that he just put all that shit, like, top loaded it.
Yeah.
It's like within the first 30 pages, you're just getting nothing but this fucking weird, you know, old English king shit that he's throwing in there that, you know, where to me the appeal of the original version is that you're like, okay, here's this weird world where there's, you know, talking ravens and multi-headed cattle and something's gone wrong, and here's this, you know, this gunslinger that's just going through this old unrecognizable world, and then he walks into a saloon and the fucking dude's playing Hey Jude on the piano and you go, what the fuck is this? that I know that song. I recognize it. You know, there's something about, you know, having that groundedness that I do miss. But, you know, I'm not blind to how that original version reads and how choppy it is and how, you know, it acts kind of as a barrier to entry. I'm not blind to that, but I also think that if you're reading the Dark Tower, you can't not start with the man, you know, the Man of Black fled across the desert, yeah. And the gunslinger followed. If you don't have the bookends to that series, if you don't have the way, you know, the last book ends and the first book begins, you know, if you don't have that experience, you're missing a chunk of it. So
yeah.
So yeah, I'm torn.
The gunslinger is like learning to play guitar on like a high action guitar. Just like it hurts, but like you can play everything so much easier after that.
Yep. But I mean, that's why you start with Eyes of the Dragon, right? Because then you can kind of seed in that. I mean, and I guess now, you know, I still haven't gotten to dive into it. But now that he's tying Talisman, you know, so directly into Dark Tower, I mean, obviously he did it with Black House, but, you know, apparently the new book is very much that. I have an advanced reading copy sitting there that's calling my name, but I'm being so slow to finish my revisit on Black House. So I don't know, you know, ultimately getting into the nitty gritty, because part of the enjoyment, though, of Dark Tower is being a dedicated Stephen King fan. Right. And coming across things where you go like, holy shit, I know that that's a character reference from this book. And, you know, in a weird way, going to the Dark Tower early is like watching, you know, Infinity War and Endgame before watching all the other Marvel movies. Right. So like, I could be convinced to get people to read the greatest hits before diving into Dark Tower.
Yeah, I wonder if that's even, like, that novel for kids now. Because, like, when we were kids, we had comic books and stuff like that. But, like, to read, I remember as a, like, young reader being like, oh, my God, that's the ghost of Frank Dodd in Cujo. And there was just, like, this feeling of, like, oh, my God, there's crossovers and stuff like that. But now everything is multiverse. So, like,
even in a weird, like, a smaller way, you know, when you realize that, you know, the sheriff that works with Johnny in the dead zone, you know, that helps track down the killer and all that, is the sheriff that gets eaten in Cujo, you know. It's like in the little things, even just mentioning, oh, you know, Derry's near Castle Rock, or there's a sign for this, you know. It's like, yeah, it was so mind-blowing, you know, the original shared universe
that,
with Stephen
King. George Bannerman thing in the dead zone and Cujo made me think of, like, slasher films, how they'll have returning cast in the sequel, and the ones who survive the previous film always die in the next one.
Yeah,
I'm like, uh-oh.
So, Brez,
I don't know what this means for Needful Things in the show.
Yeah.
He was in the dark half. He might buy the farm in this one.
Yeah, is it Pangborn? What's Pangborn going to do?
Alan Pangborn.
Yeah. So, Brez, what's your pick then? Like, what do you, you know, I still think that, you know, Eyes of the Dragon is a very good safe one. I think if you're nudging kids, you know, getting a kid to read it, you know, with all the fucking weird sex shit in it, you know, at that age, you just, that's when they're curious about all that stuff, and letting them discover that and processing that on their own, I think, is a good thing. I think it is a great one, but I think the overall safe pick for me is Eyes of the Dragon. Like, what would you go to as your?
I'm gonna go.
Are
with
you sticking with the dead zone? Or are you doing?
I'm gonna go with 11/22/63. Like,
yeah.
If I meet somebody who wants to read Stephen King, that's wants to know a good place to start with a more recent book, I would start there, or maybe The Stand.
Okay. The Stand is interesting too, because much like 11/22/63, there's a weird binge quality. It's like binge reading, right? Where you just get hooked, and every time you're ready to put it down, the end of the chapter goes, "Oh, are you sure you want to put this down?"
Yeah.
The Stand was that way for me, and there is also something, and I think I told this to King too when he came on the first time, was. You know, I remember having no. This is when I interviewed King back in my Ain't It Cool days, when I interviewed him in person. I told him that there was something about reading The Stand when I was a kid that had a big impact on me, because there's a point in the middle of that book where you kind of feel like you're in the Neverending Story. where, you know, you're turning pages because when you're doing when doing a physical book, mm-hmm. you know, you get that feeling where you're like, oh, it's weighted heavily on this end, or it's weighted heavily. I'm almost near the end. You know, the pages are all the way over there. You get in the middle of that book because it's so fucking big. You're turning pages and it doesn't feel like you're getting any closer to the end. And I remember having this feeling, reading it, going, I would be totally fine if this was the NeverEnding Story and I just get to follow these characters, you know, and I can just keep turning pages and it never gets any closer to the end and I just see what happens to these guys, right? And I remember telling him that, and he was like, yeah, there's other books, and I felt that way when I read this or whatever, and, you know, he deflected the praise, obviously, but there is something to that 11/22/63 suggestion, because you get that feeling. You can have that moment where you're in the adventure and you maybe don't want it to end, especially when you find out what what the end is, and you're like, maybe I liked it better when there was still hope.
How about you, Nat? What's your suggestion?
It's Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon for me, but 11/22/63 is definitely up there. I will say maybe this is Al Bundy of me as well, but if they do like darker stuff,
mm-hmm.
I do think Pet Sematary is a perfect novel. Like that, everything. King is an author who we love for his scope and his digressions and his kind of, you know, additional details that maybe don't need to be there but enrich the thing. But like every detail in Pet Sematary is driving towards that thesis of the cruelty of death and things like that. So if someone is going through a particularly existential moment, and unlike, say, Revival, where like the existentialism is inescapable, mm-hmm. there's still choice at the heart of right. Pet Sematary that I think is all. It's like, you know, someone asking for like what's the first play I should see, and you're like, well, if you really want to see a good play, like, you should watch Othello or King Lear. Like, that's just like the clockwork of the tragedy is so exquisite. But honestly, like, I have said this before, whenever I'm asked like what my favorite Stephen King is, my answer is kind of similar. We're like, I feel like I could kind of make the case for any of them. Some answers are more accurate than others, but like, there's such great shit in each book that even like Dreamcatcher, I could be like, let me tell you why you should start with Dreamcatcher. You like shit weasels? I'll tell you about shit weasels.
Well, as we wrap up, I think we should just acknowledge it's a moot point because nobody under the age of 18 should ever look at a Stephen King book.
Or don't do it, kids. You're not ready.
They're not ready. They're not sophisticated enough. Maybe when they get a little sand.
Yeah. You're not smart enough to handle these books or mature enough.
It's just too dangerous. I mean, they just can't. They won't be the same afterwards. Yeah. We can't allow
Your sister
that.
Could do it, but you can't.
Yeah. Well, she's more mature, you know. Good talking to you, fellas.
Yeah, perfect way to wrap this up. Thank you guys so much. And we'll see you on the next one. Many thanks to Mr. Nat Cassidy for joining us for, again, a little off the beaten path kind of episode. This isn't our traditional format, i.e. one guest, one title talked about. But I think it is an important conversation to have about introducing new people to Stephen King, especially the youths. I hope y'all got some good ideas for whenever this might pop up in your life. Or maybe you just like to hear us talk about all the Stephen King shit we love. That's kind of what we do around here. So thanks for listening. And here's a real quick plug. Make sure to sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/thekingcast. It's the single best way to support the show. Throw us a few bucks. We'll make it worth your while. Tons of bonus episodes, access to Discord, yada, yada, yada. We also love getting reviews. That helps other people discover the show. So review us highly on your podcatcher of choice. And or sign up for our Patreon. Those are your two options. You must do one before this day ends, or I will know and I will find you and I will chastise you. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next one. Adios, folks. The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler. We'll be right back.